Welcome to the deep dive. I want you to imagine something for a second. Imagine carrying a single, incredibly fragile memory in your mind for 26 years.
Wow, 26 years. That's a long time to hold on to just one moment.
Right, and you aren't just holding on to it as time passes. You are literally carrying this memory across international borders. You're carrying it through a completely new language, a total shift in culture.
A completely different way of life, really.
Exactly. Your whole reality is basically turned upside down and shaken out, but you keep this one specific image perfectly intact in your head.
Right.
And then, nearly 3 decades later, you finally decide, okay, it is time to capture
So
this.
you don't use something permanent, right?
No, that's the
Right.
crazy part. You don't carve it into stone, you don't cast it in bronze or whatever to make it last forever. You decide to document this precious, delicate memory using, well, pretty much the most volatile, unforgiving artistic medium that exists, water.
Which is just a beautiful contradiction when you really stop to analyze it.
Yeah.
The mechanics of that choice are fascinating.
Yeah, and that's exactly our mission today. We are looking at a brilliant breakdown of a watercolor painting titled Daniel. It was created by the artist Jairo Duque, and it's featured in his book Trastio Pintura Artistica.
Yeah, and through his notes, we get this rare, almost microscopic look into how a massive life transition gets distilled down to a single 9 by 12 inch piece of paper.
It's honestly amazing. So we're not just going to do some superficial gallery tour here. We are going to deconstruct the mechanics of this artwork chronologically. Because to understand what is happening with the paint on the paper today, we have to travel back in time to the exact moment this memory was born.
Right, we have to move away from the present day canvas in his studio.
Yeah, we have to look at a 26-year-old photograph.
So to give you some background, the painting is based on a photograph from the 1990s. And it just features the artist's son, Daniel, playing in a park seen from behind.
Which I have to admit, when I first looked at the source material, I was like, wait, are we risking overanalyzing a completely ordinary afternoon?
Right, because it just looks like a standard picture.
Exactly. Pretty much everyone listening right now probably has a faded 90s photo of a kid in a park, you know, sitting in a shoebox somewhere. It feels so ubiquitous that it almost, I don't know, strips away any deeper meaning.
Well, yeah, and that is a totally natural reaction to have.
Yeah.
But context is really the only thing that alters the gravity of an image like this.
And the context here is super heavy.
It's incredibly heavy. The family had just arrived in the United States from Colombia. They were newly arrived immigrants, smack in the middle of that initial overwhelming phase of uprooting.
Which changes the temperature of the room completely. We aren't just looking at a lazy Sunday in a neighborhood they've lived in for generations.
Far from it. I mean, the trauma behind that kind of uprooting is profound.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
That initial phase of migration, it's profoundly disorienting. You're dealing with severe culture shock, an impenetrable language barrier where, even buying groceries is a monumental task.
Oh man, just the grocery store alone, trying to figure out labels when you don't speak the language.
Exactly. And you have the sudden loss of every familiar routine you've ever known. The outside world is completely alien, and it often feels incredibly hostile.
Because adapting to it requires this exhausting psychological effort just to survive the day, right?
Yes, every single interaction requires translation, calculation, and this constant fear of making a misstep.
I just think about how exhausting it is starting a new job in a new office.
Right, just learning the printer.
Exactly, let alone a new country where you don't know the unspoken social rules. The parents are under this crushing weight to figure out housing, employment, the language.
All while trying to project stability for their children.
Which brings us to this really vital quote from Duke's own notes. He describes this specific artwork as, let me find it. Okay. Memory, testimony, and affection condensed in color and paper.
Affection condensed in color and paper. That is just, it really frames the park in a totally new light.
It does. It makes it feel less like a public recreation area and more like, I don't know, an emotional windbreak. The author's notes actually mention this idea of an emotional trench.
An emotional trench.
Yeah, and initially I pictured something out of a war movie, which felt a bit dramatic for a trip to the park. But when you consider the sheer psychological bombardment of assimilation, a trench makes total sense. It is a bunker.
A psychological bunker is a great way to put it. In child psychology, especially concerning migration and trauma, family resilience often operates exactly like this.
Really? Like a physical space?
Well, the family unit itself becomes the only real, reliable refuge. So that afternoon in the park, it wasn't just playtime, it was an active mechanism for survival.
Because in a world where the adults are navigating that relentless pressure cooker of a new country, a shared playtime around a toy becomes a designated safe zone.
Right. It's a space where the family's identity remains completely intact.
They're speaking their native language, they're engaging in their own family dynamics, and most importantly, the children can just be children.
Yes. Shielded for an afternoon from the chaos of the adults' reality. The park temporarily suspends the reality of their displacement.
So knowing the incredible emotional weight of this 26-year-old memory, we can now fast forward to July 2022.
Right, to witness how this intangible feeling physically materializes.
Yeah, in the artist's current laboratory, basically. So we move to his studio in Whittier, California.
And the physical materials he chooses to bring this to life are highly specific. He uses a 9x12-inch sheet of 300-gram watercolor paper.
Okay, so this is where I didn't totally get the medium choice at first. If this memory is so precious and you've guarded it for almost 3 decades, why use watercolor?
Because it's so unpredictable.
Exactly. It's basically controlled chaos. Wouldn't your instinct tell you to use a robust, forgiving medium, like oil paint or acrylics, where if you mess up a shadow, you can just let it dry and paint over it?
You'd think so, yeah. But choosing water is a deliberate embrace of that chaos. To understand why, we really have to look at the chemistry of the medium and how it relates to the fragility of memory.
Okay, break that down for me.
So watercolor is essentially finely ground pigment suspended in a water binder. When you apply that to standard paper, the cellulose fibers in the wood pulp immediately start to expand as they absorb the moisture.
They swell unevenly, which is why, like, cheap drawing paper gets all wavy and buckled if you get it wet.
Exactly. And eventually, the paper just starts peeling and falling apart.
Just disintegrates.
Right. But that melting is exactly what the 300-gram paper is engineered to prevent. 300-gram paper is incredibly thick. It is practically heavy cardboard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's manufactured under immense pressure with a precise sizing. Sizing is a type of glue to ensure it has the exact level of absorption necessary to literally drink the water without losing its flat structural integrity.
That's fascinating. So the memory itself is fragile, but the foundation holding it has to be immensely resilient.
Exactly.
Which perfectly mirrors the family, right? Just like the family unit had to be incredibly resilient to protect the fragile innocence of the kids during that migration.
That is a perfect parallel. The technical reality of the paint dictates how the artist has to work, and it actually forces a very specific psychological state.
Because you can't just slap it on.
No, not at all. To create those smooth, beautiful gradients of a blue sky in watercolor, you don't just scrub a brush back and forth like you would with house paint.
Right.
You have to wet that heavy paper first, apply concentrated pigment at the very top of the page, and then tilt the board. You're allowing gravity and the water itself to drag the color down.
You are basically orchestrating a controlled flood.
It is a terrifying balance. It requires intense control over your mixture,
right,
but also this total surrender to physics.
Because if you mess up...
If you use too much water, the pigment disperses wildly and the piece is completely ruined.
And if you use too little...
The paint dries too fast and you get these harsh artificial lines called cauliflowers where the water pulls and pushes the pigment away.
Man, that seems incredibly stressful. And Duke is actually very vulnerable in his notes about this whole process.
He is, yeah.
He talks about this piece being an early exploration into watercolor for him. Like, he openly admits that his anatomical definitions of the boy's figure are a bit weak.
Yeah, and the tonal contrasts aren't as sharp as they could be to separate the subject from the background.
Right. He calls these attempts pinceladas contenidas, which translates to contained brush strokes.
Contained brush strokes. I love that. He is openly listing what an academic art critic might call, you know, flaws or beginner's mistakes.
Yeah, he's cautious. He's measuring the terrain of the paper the exact same way one measures the terrain of a new skill.
Or a new country.
Exactly. And I love that he kept those flaws in the final piece. Because perfection can be so sterile, you know.
Completely.
A contained brushstroke is like hearing someone tell a deeply painful, incredibly personal story. If they tell it with the flawless, polished diction of a professional news anchor, you almost don't trust it.
Right. It feels rehearsed. Or distant somehow.
Yeah. But if they tell it with a trembling, hesitant voice, if they stumble over a word, those imperfections validate the authenticity of the emotion.
The hesitation proves the emotion is real. And instead of throwing the painting away because of these technical flaws, the artist validates them. He treats them as archaeological records of his learning process.
Which brings us to this massive parallel in the source material.
Yeah, it's so profound. The artist's cautious stumbling process of learning to navigate the unpredictable nature of water and pigment. It perfectly mirrors the immigrant family's cautious, hopeful struggle to adapt to the United States 26 years earlier.
The adaptation to a new country and the technical adaptation to the paint are basically symmetrical journeys.
They really are.
Making mistakes in a new language feels a lot like making an irreversible mistake on wet paper. You are taking these tentative, unsure steps in both scenarios, surrendering control and just hoping things settle correctly.
And he values those marks of learning on the paper way more than he values technical perfection. Just as a family must eventually value their messy, imperfect survival over some idealized version of their lives.
That is so well said. So now that we understand how the piece was constructed and the trauma and learning that birthed it, we can step back and look at what is actually painted on this heavy paper.
Right. Let's shift from the artist's technique to the viewer's psychological experience of the composition.
Visually, the architecture of the painting sounds incredibly simple at first. We see Daniel, seen from behind. He is wearing a bright, vibrant red shirt and white shorts.
Okay.
And he's reaching his left arm high up toward a blue toy that is floating in a vast blue sky. Beneath him, there is this green and ochre grass.
The color theory in this simple layout is doing immense heavy lifting to manipulate how you perceive the space.
Really? Just with red and blue?
Oh, absolutely. Hmm. The warm red of the boy's shirt naturally advances toward the viewer's eye. Warm colors, like reds, oranges, yellows, they always appear closer in our visual field.
Oh, okay.
And the cool blue of the vast sky naturally recedes into the background. So by placing a vibrant warm color against a vast cool color, the artist instantly creates a profound sense of depth on a totally flat piece of paper.
That's such a smart trick.
But the real genius of the composition is in the geometry of the pose.
You mean the diagonal line of his arm?
Exactly. Think about the psychology of lines and how they make you feel intuitively.
Okay.
A horizontal line, like a landscape or a sunset over the ocean, that transmits calm and rest.
Just very peaceful.
And a vertical line, like a tall tree trunk or a skyscraper, that transmits stability, firmness, and strength. But a diagonal line, like Daniel's arm reaching upward and outward across the canvas, that represents action.
It creates visual tension.
Right. It is the literal graphic representation of pure wonder and movement. It forces your eye to move from the bottom left corner up to the top right.
Your eye just naturally starts at his feet, which are firmly planted on the ground, travels up the tension of his body, goes right up that diagonal arm, and shoots straight into the sky.
Yes.
And the symbolism of those different zones of the painting is so rich when you think about the immigrant context.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
The ochre and green ground serves as the emotional anchor. It represents gravity. It represents that safe trench of the family unit holding him steady.
And that vast blue sky above him, that represents the open canvas of the future. It is the infinite, intimidating realm of possibilities that this newly arrived family is facing.
And here is where the specific details of the memory become completely fascinating. The object in the sky, the toy he is reaching for, was a blue, early 90s recreational drone.
Yeah, but we have to remember the context of the 90s here. To a kid back then, and honestly to society in general, a weird remote-controlled flying saucer wasn't called a drone.
No, the concept of a consumer drone as a flying camera or a common toy, it just simply didn't exist in the cultural lexicon.
It looked like a UFO.
Totally.
It looked like alien technology. And the artist's notes point out that this shared fascination with science fiction, with aliens and other worlds, was a massive bonding point for him and his son at the time. They were just obsessed with the idea of the extraterrestrial.
Which is such a poignant detail when you consider their day-to-day reality in 90s California.
It really is. Think about the poetry of this scenario for a second. You have a newly arrived immigrant child. He is likely feeling completely alien in a strange new country.
Yeah, he's an outsider.
He's surrounded by a strange language, unfamiliar customs, and a society he doesn't fully understand yet. And what is he doing in this moment of safety?
Reaching for a UFO.
Exactly. He is firmly anchored by his family and literally reaching up into the vast unknown sky to connect with a UFO, with something alien.
It becomes the ultimate visual metaphor for the immigrant experience.
It really does. He is metamorphosing that deep existential anxiety of being an outsider into radiant hope and intense curiosity. He isn't shrinking from the alien world, you know. He is reaching for it, trying to make contact.
And this perfectly illustrates the power of art to rewrite our internal narratives.
Right.
It takes a memory that was rooted in a period of profound stress, cultural displacement, and just general fear of an unknown future.
Right.
And by filtering it through luminous watercolors and focusing entirely on a moment of childhood wonder, the artist transforms the trauma.
He sublimates it.
Yes. He sublimates the anxiety of the immigrant experience into a permanent monument of resilience and curiosity.
So we've traced this journey from a seemingly mundane photograph in a shoebox to the technical struggles of water and pigment in a Whittier studio, and finally unpacked the immense symbolic triumph on the paper.
It's quite a journey.
But where does this piece live today, and what does its existence actually prove for the family?
Well, according to the source notes, Daniel currently hangs framed in a family room in Southern California.
Not in a gallery.
Nope. It isn't in a museum or a gallery. It is a permanent fixture in their daily domestic lives.
Just hanging on a wall. But it is carrying an impossible amount of weight.
Yeah, it really is.
A single 9x12-inch piece of paper holds the innocence of childhood, 90s technology, the trauma of international migration, the chemistry of water, and the unyielding resilience of a family's love.
Which highlights a crucial and, I think, often overlooked function of artistic creation, especially outside of the commercial art world. Art, in its most deeply personal forms, is a profound act of resistance.
Resistance against erasure, right.
Exactly. Resistance against time and circumstance. Because memories fade, generations move on, and the specific struggles of assimilation, they often get smoothed over or forgotten completely by the time the grandchildren are born.
Yeah, it just becomes a vague family story.
Right. But by taking the time to physically fix this fragile memory onto a demanding permanent medium like 300-gram paper, the artist is actively resisting the forces that dissolve our personal histories.
He is refusing to let the unique identity and the quiet victories of his immigrant family just disappear into the ether.
Elevating what might have been, you know, a simple technical painting exercise into an invaluable historical document for his lineage, it proves they were there. They navigated the unknown and they survived.
They didn't just survive that emotional trench. They eventually thrived enough to look back and paint it. Well, we have covered some truly massive territory today. We started by looking at a simple splash of water on heavy paper and ended up charting an exhaustive map of human survival, technical learning, and family legacy.
It definitely forces you to reconsider the depth and the origin stories of the images we surround ourselves with every single day.
It really does. Which brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with, something to mull over long after this deep dive ends. We just saw how a completely routine afternoon in a park, just a kid chasing a plastic toy in the sky, carried enough emotional gravity to preserve an entire family's identity across decades.
Mm-hmm.
So what seemingly trivial, fleeting moment in your life right now, a moment you are totally taking for granted, will unexpectedly become the glowing beacon that guides and gives meaning to the next generations of your own history. Take care, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.